Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A new report says West Virginia can do more with solar power.
It's really hard to deny something that has a free fuel source, that creates local jobs.
Senator Jay Rockefeller expresses his opinion about the West Virginia water crisis.
I wouldn't drink that water if you paid me.
A Marshall University student is watching the Winter Olympics with extra special interest.
Maybe a year ago, I was there and I was walking on all the streets, and now I see it on TV, and now people see all the beauty that our people just built.
And for Jessica Lilly, all this snow is a slippery slope.
Well, I made it. Lots of spinning, but I made it. That was fun.
These stories and more are coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Our region is known for producing energy. Historically, that's been coal, and recently, we've added natural gas. Another energy source that could bring jobs and lower electric bills is solar. The Kentucky General Assembly is considering a number of bills that would encourage the use of renewable energy, and WMMT's Mimi Pickering reports on a new study on the potential of solar power for West Virginians.
It's been a bit gloomy in these parts the last few weeks, but that hasn't stopped folks in West Virginia from studying the power of the sun. The Mountain Institute and Downstream Strategies have just released a report explaining the benefits of solar energy in West Virginia, with policy recommendations to increase its development. Aaron Such, Energy Program Manager at the Mountain Institute, is one of the authors of Using Solar PV to Create Economic Diversity, 5 Policy Recommendations.
We thought the solar paper would be an excellent opportunity to show a possible solution for a couple issues, specifically rising energy prices. We've seen gas prices rise, that's pretty obvious, but also electricity prices in West Virginia have risen an average of about 50% in the last 5 years. And in addition to some of the environmental issues with fossil fuel extraction. So we thought we'd put this out as an example of a way to create economic opportunity to engage a conversation with a broad range of folks. We're open to speaking to whomever, and ways to just show that solar energy has a real potential for economic development, to create energy diversity, and to really help people out on the local level.
Jeff Simcoe from Downstream Strategies also authored the report. He says that supportive state policies in the neighboring states of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Maryland have helped create 9,000 solar industry jobs, while West Virginia has under 100.
You know, right now throughout the U.S., solar has employed over 120,000 workers, whereas, and that was a figure from 2012, and in 2012, the coal mining industry employed less than 100,000 people. So what we see it as is an opportunity to not necessarily compete with coal or natural gas, but to provide opportunities for people in a different industry to promote economic development and also to open up jobs that aren't necessarily here in the state right now. We don't have any manufacturing of solar panels in the state, so that's one area that we could try to attract solar manufacturer to the state. Other types of jobs, you're looking at electricians and contractors and folks that design the systems. There's obviously sales and engineering type positions. So, the workforce in West Virginia would match up well with this industry.
Nathaniel Than Hitt is a part of Sustainable Shepherdstown.
About 3 years ago, my wife and I decided to put solar panels on our house. What's important is that this is a historic district, and so we had to really approach the siting questions with some care. We wanted to make sure that these panels would be as productive as they could be, but we wanted to minimize visibility because of the historic nature of Shepherdstown. We were able to do that, and I think this could be a model for solar development in places that have historic preservation values as well. There's a lot of interest and excitement for solar power in Shepherdstown and in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia in general. We see some forward momentum. Now, there are important obstacles, and I'm glad that Downstream Strategies and others are looking at these. Certainly, there are obstacles at the legislative level and throughout the state. Look, if we look at the big picture, we get more sunlight than Germany, but Germany is the world's leader in solar at the moment. It's not a lack of sunlight that limits our capacity for solar. It's a lack of political will and creativity. But we do see progress being made at the community level, and I think that's really encouraging.
Aaron Such from the Mountain Institute again.
Even though West Virginia is not Arizona or California, the technology for solar is advancing so much that it really is, it works for West Virginia. And I'll just give you a quick example. At the Morgantown Farmers Market, where we installed 12 solar panels, those 12 solar panels, since April, have produced enough power to power 100 homes for one day, right here in West Virginia. So if you look at the data, it basically indicates that solar does work. The more people that know about it and really see the positive aspects of it, it's really hard to deny something that has a free fuel source, that creates local jobs, and that enhances energy diversity. I mean, how can you be against something like that?
That was Aaron Such. The report from the Mountain Institute in Downstream Strategies offers 5 policy recommendations that would help reduce upfront costs of solar PV equipment, improve market access for solar energy, and provide incentives to help residents, businesses, and nonprofits use solar power. You can download the report at downstreamstrategies.com/projects. Reporting for WMMT, this is Mimi Pickering.
And as West Virginia Public Radio's Glynis Board tells us, this report caught the attention of Robin Mahonen, founder of a group called Wheeling Water Warriors.
It inspired her to organize a public event for the Wheeling community to learn more about solar options.
Our primary objective has been to bring attention and awareness and education to the people about the issues related to fracking in our community, particularly the possible dangers to public health and the environment. And not wanting to be your negative Nancy, so to speak, we decided that it was very important for us to not only say what we don't want, but also what we do want, and to present some viable alternatives for the community in terms of renewables and solar power and that type of thing.
One of the report's authors, Aaron Such, gave the presentation at the event, which took place at Wheeling Jesuit University. Such is the energy program manager at the Mountain Institute, an organization with a mission to promote economic development in mountain regions that include West Virginia and Nepal. He says solar power is a practical option to mitigate rising energy costs.
Well, solar is certainly feasible. In fact, right here in Wheeling, for example, we get about 80% of the solar resource that Miami does. Compared to Germany, which is the world leader in solar, they have 5 times the amount of installed solar that we do. We get nearly twice as much solar resource that they do. Solar is just a tremendously strong resource that is capable of being captured in a lot of different climates, and West Virginia is no exception.
Such says with proper policy incentives and some public enthusiasm, solar is pretty well set to soar in West Virginia.
For an average resident, there's a lot of incentives available right now, and you have to remember with solar that you're actually prepaying your electricity for as long as the system lasts. In this case, solar is estimated to last at more than 35 years. And you're also paying for the benefit of being able to produce your own electricity and that independence. So in many cases, we're seeing payback periods starting to shorten as the technology gets better. And it really just takes a longer-term perspective.
As for Robin Mahonen of the Wheeling Water Warriors, she says she and her husband, Ed, are jumping onto the solar bandwagon as soon as possible.
Eddie and I will be looking into putting solar power on our house this late spring, early summer, as soon as the ice melts, we're going to get those panels up there. We're very excited about that.
Mahonin is also happy that Wheeling city officials have agreed to hear a similar presentation. That is scheduled for early March. Such says he'll also be speaking with community members in Morgantown later this month.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
Another form of energy, natural gas, continues to garner attention in Pennsylvania. The most active drilling company in the state's forest is Anadarko Energy. A new report from an environmental group says the Houston-based company is doing a bad job of drilling safety. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
The Environmental Integrity Project reports that Anadarko Petroleum had over 246 environmental violations over a five-year period. The report singled out Anadarko's record on water discharges. It noted the company ranked near the bottom out of 600 operators in Pennsylvania in the rate of spill or leak-related violations per inspection. These include spills of frac fluid on well pads and leaks in well casings. Environmental groups are fighting the state's plans to allow Anadarko to drill on 19,000 acres of the Loyal Sauk State Forest. Anadarko owns part of the mineral rights to the land, but opponents of the plan say a special deed means the state doesn't have to allow drilling there. In a written response, a company spokeswoman said Anadarko was one of the most responsible operators in the state, and that the company promptly reports and responds to any issues that arise at its sites. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Congress came to Charleston, West Virginia this past week to learn more about the chemical spill into the Elk River that contaminated the water supply for 300,000 people. The House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure heard firsthand from state and local officials about how the disaster was handled. NPR's Bob Naylor has more.
It's a small word, safe, but try as she might, Republican Representative Shelley Moore Capito couldn't get witnesses at a congressional hearing in Charleston yesterday to utter it. She tried first with the head of Charleston's water supply company, Jeff McIntyre.
Is the water safe to drink?
As a water company, we don't set the safe standards, but we are in compliance with all the standards set by the health-based agencies.
Capito then put the question to Letitia Tierney, Commissioner of West Virginia's Department of Health and Human Resources.
Dr. Tierney, is the water safe to drink?
Everybody has a different definition. Am I confident in the science? I'm as confident as I can be, given what we had.
While the investigation continues into the accident, residents continue to have misgivings about Charleston's water supply. People still line up at water distribution points, and restaurants serve bottled water with lunch. Sue Davis testified that she's lived in the Kanawha Valley, also known as Chemical Valley, for 71 years.
We simply don't have that much confidence in your water system to begin with, so it's going to be a long time before you restore faith in it again, and you will never have mine.
West Virginia has long relied on the exploitation of its natural resources to provide its residents with a way to earn a living. If coal is no longer king here, it is still a force to be reckoned with, and the chemical industry also has been a key part of the economy. The federal EPA has been portrayed by some state officials as the enemy. But last month's spill may be changing the equation. Republican Capito is sponsoring a bill requiring oversight and inspection of chemical storage facilities.
I don't think the point is that anybody wants no regulations. You want regulations that protect the air and the water in a common sense way. And I think in this instance, we've seen there are enormous gaps both in the state and the local responders and in the federal law. So I think what we need to do is address the regulatory gaps. I think that's what we're expected to do.
Democratic Senator Joe Manchin famously ran a campaign ad in which he fired a rifle aimed at federal environmental legislation. Manchin says what happened with Charleston's water should serve as a wake-up call.
There's got to be a balance between the economy and the environment. To a certain extent, it always has been.
Does this incident, though, show that maybe things are not so much in balance?
Well, it shows that basically throughout the whole country, this could have happened anywhere. It happened right here. We have to anticipate what could happen and prevent it if we can and be able to handle if it does. And that's where we are.
Manchin, too, is sponsoring a bill in the Senate requiring regular inspections of above-ground chemical storage facilities. All of this gives a bit of hope to advocates like Angie Rosser of the West Virginia Rivers Coalition.
Sadly, it took a catastrophe to get us here, but it's encouraging that light is being shed on some of the systemic problems that we've endured in West Virginia at the cost of our water.
And many say the water here still contains the telltale odor of licorice associated with the leaked chemical, and they're far from ready to declare it safe. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Charleston.
Many have criticized officials for failure to test water in homes. After the congressional hearing, Governor Earl Ray Tomlin announced the creation of a project that will do just that. The three-step program could take weeks to complete, but the independent scientist leading the effort says the study is unlike any other and could set a standard for chemical testing in drinking water across the country. West Virginia Public Radio's Ashton Mara reports.
I'm announcing that we will move forward with the West Virginia Testing Assessment Project, or WVTAP.
Governor Tomlin made the announcement during a press conference at the Capitol, repeatedly calling the project unprecedented, not just for West Virginia, but the country. The program is headed by Dr. Andrew Welton, assistant professor of environmental engineering at South Alabama University, with the help of scientists from Massachusetts-based Corona Environmental Consulting. Welton explained WVTAP has three main objectives. The first is to assemble a panel of health risk assessment experts nationwide to assess the 10 parts per billion safety threshold set by the state for the chemical MCHM in drinking water. That process has already started. Second, scientists will initiate an in-depth analysis to determine the odor threshold for MCHM. Welton says it's likely a person can smell the chemical at a lower level than what laboratory equipment can test for. He says they are consulting with scientists who can conduct this type of study. Third, his team will begin testing the water from taps in 10 homes. Testing is taking place on a voluntary basis in one home in each county and two in Kanawha because of its size. While the number may sound small, Welton explains this initial sample is a pilot on which a larger study of possibly thousands of homes will be based.
The 10-home number was determined to be significant based on the information of the questions we're trying to ask. So it's all about the questions. What do you really want to know when you do some type of testing? We need to answer, is MCHM levels higher in hot water versus cold water? We can answer that with 10 homes. We can see if that is a significant question that we need to be asking to the larger thousands of homes study. We can determine if it matters between what kitchen faucet or the bathroom. Are there differences in MCHM levels? We can determine if that's even a significant question or at both locations they are the same. Then we will make the decisions based on the data obtained there and apply it to the thousands of homes study.
Welton says it will take 3 weeks for his team of four to collect all of the samples in homes, then another 7 to 10 days to have the completed lab results, and even more time before a final report can be drafted. But Welton adds there won't be a blackout of information until that report is complete. He expects initial test results next week and will be sharing the information as it's available. It will take time, however, because they are setting a precedent, he says, for how these tests will be completed in the future.
This incident demonstrated what happens when you don't know really anything about the chemical. So how does the government respond to an incident? Is it like a typical incident, or next time this happens, do they initiate these animal studies immediately while responding to the incident to generate that data? Do other federal agencies initiate other labs testing studies that they can obtain data in 3 to 5 days? So to my knowledge, that hasn't happened, and I think that would have gone a long way towards helping the citizens of West Virginia understand what's happening to the water.
As for cost, Tomlin says he's committed $650,000 from his budget for the initial work. But that's just the beginning. He says he's reaching out to members of Congress for additional aid from the federal government as the project continues.
The way I look at this is, you know, this is not just a West Virginia problem. I mean, to have an incident such as this, it's something that could happen all over the country. And so I've asked them to see if there are other ways that we can get some assistance because, you know, once this report is back and once the after incident report is done, I think this will probably be a blueprint should other cities or other states face similar types of crisis like this.
Tomlin says Jeff McIntyre, president of West Virginia American Water, has offered to help pay for the cost of testing, but no assistance has been accepted by the state. Welton agrees $650,000 will only be a start. He says the government needs to initiate animal toxicity studies and medical monitoring, which will only add to the bottom line.
So I need to be frank. This is not going to be easy, and it's not going to be tomorrow. But the federal government needs to engage the best and brightest minds in the world to come in. We need help. We need additional researchers from around the U.S. We need additional funding to give to those researchers. This is simply a monumental, unprecedented chemical drinking water contamination incident, a disaster.
As for the safety of the water, a question repeatedly asked during a congressional hearing held in Charleston Monday, Welton says this.
I drink the water here. I bathe in the water here. I believe it's safe for me. But there is a national and international discourse happening right now about whether or not the water is safe in Charleston, West Virginia.
Welton believes his study will be able to determine whether or not the water is in fact safe, hopefully restoring the public's confidence. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
Meanwhile, West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller offered a statement to the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure that says it's dangerous to rely on industry to do the right thing. Shortly after the spill, Rockefeller asked the Federal Chemical Safety Board to investigate. He spoke with NPR's Melissa Block about the situation.
Senator Rockefeller, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa. I wouldn't drink that water if you paid me.
Really? Well, that was my first question. Would you drink the water? And you say no.
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Well, because it nobody has said that it's safe. Everybody, the CDC, the EPA, they all come out and say, do what you think is appropriate. And here are these 300,000 people, and really many more than that when you think of the way this spreads, who are living in absolute frustration for an entire month when they can't do any of the basic things that you do. If you can't drink water, you can't do anything.
Hasn't the message, though, not just been do what you think is appropriate? I mean, they've been hearing from federal and state and local authorities, yeah, go ahead, drink it, bathe in it. Well, wait a minute, maybe not if you're pregnant, don't drink it. But it seems that there was a rush to judgment from folks saying, look, the water supply is safe.
The real story to me behind this is twofold. One is that West Virginia as a state, traditionally, I'm very sorry to say, has been rather bad at enforcing regulations. People have the view, many people have the view, particularly those in industry, that if you regulate them, they'll go out of business and people will get laid off. When this is a perfect example of when you don't regulate them, dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of businesses have to close down, schools close down, people can't go to school, people can't do anything, people can't escape. If you've got money, you can escape to a second home somewhere up in the eastern part of the state, but most people can't do that. I mean, it's a travesty really beyond description.
Well, let me ask you about that. You say this is a travesty beyond description. You were governor of West Virginia before you became a senator.
I was.
Your fellow senator is a Democrat. The governor of West Virginia is a Democrat. Doesn't the Democratic Party bear some responsibility for the climate of regulation and what's been allowed to happen in West Virginia?
Well, you will find the person you're talking to is very, very strong on those things. That people vary. I mean, some people, they get elected by saying, I'm against regulations. But I mean, you know, everybody's responsible. Democrats are responsible. Everybody's responsible.
What about the argument, Senator, that I'm sure you've heard many, many times over the years, that industry is the backbone of the economy of your state, whether it's coal or the chemical industry? I think this is called Chemical Valley, where this spill occurred. And there's a balance to be struck there, and those the economy of your state is very dependent on that industry.
There's a balance to be struck, and there's no question about that. But that's poetry coming out of your mouth. It's just totally doesn't mean anything mm-hmm. in reality. There never has been a balance in West Virginia. The chemical industry, the coal industry in particular, other industries are just do what they want. Coal companies own large sections of West Virginia. They employ thousands of West Virginians at very high salaries. And if they didn't have that job, there'd be no other job because the state doesn't do anything to help train people for, quote, those other jobs. So the industries always win, the people always lose, and it's the story of West Virginia, at least in part, and it's infuriating.
Do you see this as a turning point for West Virginians in how they feel about industry?
I guess I don't want to guide how they feel about industry. All I want them to do is to be able to get their legislators to, and particularly at the state level where they're doing it, but also at the federal level. If they don't do it at the state level, well, then by God, we're going to do it at the federal level, to regulate these chemicals, which right now don't have to be inspected at all. Put in tough regulations. Make them every 2 or 3 years, make state inspectors and or federal inspectors go in there and check them. This country is very fragile environmentally. It's going precisely the wrong way environmentally and cheered on by industry. Industries win, people lose. It's an old formula.
Well, Senator Rockefeller, thank you for talking with us today.
Melissa, thank you.
That's Senator Jay Rockefeller, Democrat of West Virginia, speaking with us from his Senate office.
And this side note, Senator Rockefeller received the Grand Cordon of the Order of the Rising Sun from the Japanese government this past week. The award recognizes Rockefeller for decades of work strengthening and promoting the relationship between Japan and the United States. The award was established in 1875 and is the country's highest honor for foreigners. The issue of same-sex marriage is being debated in several Appalachian states. In Virginia, a federal judge has declared that state's law banning same-sex marriage unconstitutional. Legal challenges are also pending in Tennessee and West Virginia. 10 years ago, Kentucky's lawmakers and residents approved an amendment to the state constitution banning same-sex marriage. But now U.S. District Judge John Heyburn has knocked the legal footing out from under that measure, saying it violates the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. Heyburn's ruling only means the state must recognize same-sex marriages performed outside the state. But it looks to be a matter of time before another case comes along seeking to throw out the entire amendment. Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meter has more on how the ban went from overwhelmingly popular to a political landmine in just one decade.
2004 was a very different time, politically and socially. George W. Bush was poised to sail into a second term in the White House. Hearings in Saddam Hussein's war crimes trial began in earnest, and Shrek 2 was making millions at the box office. And Kentucky, along with 10 other states, voted to ban same-sex marriages. The amendment began as a Senate bill introduced by former Russell Springs Republican Senator Vernie McGahey. It handily passed in the Republican-controlled chamber by a wide margin. Only 5 senators, all Democrats, cast dissenting votes. It then passed the House and was signed into law by former Republican Governor Ernie Fletcher. It went on the November ballot, and voters were overwhelmingly in support of it. Senator Dan Syme was a co-sponsor of that original bill. He finds Heyburn's ruling disappointing.
I believe that marriage is between one man and one woman, and we've went a long way in this country, in my opinion, to destroying the traditional marriage. And we're seeing that in our youth, who are just floundering out there with the lack of a father in the living in the home. and it's just about destroyed the family unit this country has, and I'll stick by my guns that I believe that marriage is one man and one woman.
Syme says he would support a legislative effort to pass a new constitutional amendment in the Senate in response to the ruling, and he may have bipartisan support. Senator Ray Jones Jr., a Democrat from Pikeville, voted for the ban on the basis of his religious beliefs, which he says haven't changed over the last decade. He doesn't think the legal battle is going to be over anytime soon.
Judge Haber's decision, of course, will have to be resolved through the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and ultimately I suspect that the United States Supreme Court will address that issue.
A recent poll showed the continued unpopularity of same-sex marriage across the state, but there are pockets where attitudes have changed significantly. Six Kentucky cities have adopted local fairness ordinances, half of them in the last year alone. Senator Gerald Neal was one of five Democrats to vote against the marriage ban, and he's surprised at the progress that LGBT rights have made.
It's interesting what's happening, because if you go back 5-6 years, it looked like there was a total different ballgame unfolding here.
The difference is stark enough that Senator Morgan McGarvey, who has filed a statewide fairness bill in his chamber, says that even if Syme and other GOP members were to mount a renewed effort to pass a constitutional amendment, the support wouldn't be as strong.
Right now, this is playing out in the proper channel, and that's in the courts. I'm not going to support any law in the state Senate that fails to treat people equally.
But efforts to pass a new ban may be for naught. It's unclear how Governor Steve Beshear and Attorney General Jack Conway will react to the ban. They defended it in court, but haven't yet said whether they will appeal. And while Haber's ruling was in reference to out-of-state marriages, it says the entire ban is unconstitutional. Proponents of marriage equality hope it's interpreted that way. Michael Aldridge is executive director of the ACLU of Kentucky.
My understanding that it strikes down the whole amendment to the state constitution as completely unconstitutional, not just a portion. What we saw this summer at the U.S. Supreme Court with the DOMA decision was a section of DOMA that was ruled unconstitutional, but I believe this decision today speaks to the entire amendment to the Kentucky Constitution.
Aldridge hopes the state won't appeal, and he cites states like Virginia and Illinois that have let similar decisions stand. But if there is an appeal, Aldridge says the ACLU will throw all of its resources into the case in support of Haber's decision. No matter what happens next, it's clear this decision has energized both sides of the debate. But Fairness Campaign Director Chris Hartman says momentum is on his side. He says marriage equality is inevitable, and non-discrimination laws are, too.
LGBT rights and fairness rights will continue to move forward in the Commonwealth as they have been. We'll see more cities pass anti-discrimination fairness laws. We'll ultimately see the state of Kentucky pass the anti-discrimination fairness ordinance, which will give everyone a fair shake at earning a living, putting a roof over their heads, and eating at their favorite restaurant.
Although a finalized order is expected to come through the courts in the coming week, the outcome may not be realized in Kentucky for several more years. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meter.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Racing fans at Churchill Downs will hear a new voice calling the action when the spring meet begins. As Kentucky Public Radio's Rick Hallett reports, Larry Kalmus becomes just the seventh person to hold the position of track announcer.
And the pack is catching up quickly. Through on the inside is Oxbow.
Larry Kalmus's voice is already familiar to many racing fans. He's called the last three Kentucky Derbies for NBC.
Taking the lead on the outside. Orb is coming with giant strides in the center of the track. And here comes Orb.
That's from Comus's stretch call of last year's run for the Roses. The 47-year-old Maryland native will continue to call Triple Crown and Breeders' Cup races for NBC in addition to his duties in Louisville. He'll also stay on as the winner meet announcer at Gulfstream Park in Florida. Kalmus succeeds Mark Johnson, the track's first British announcer, who's moving on after 5 years at Churchill Downs. The home of the Kentucky Derby hired its first track announcer, Gene Schmidt, in 1940. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville.
The 2014 Olympics continue, and each day millions of viewers here in the United States tune in to catch up on which athletes are winning medals. One student at Marshall University has a unique perspective as she watches on television. West Virginia Public Radio's Clark Davis has more.
When Anna Pomotenskaya talks about Sochi, Russia, she's reflecting on a place she calls home. The freshman Marshall University tennis player just arrived on campus in January after spending the last few years at IMG Academy in Florida. She says she's not been back to Sochi since winter break of the 2012-2013 school year. She says her home looks completely different.
It's really exciting, but at the same time, it's a little bit unbelievable how maybe a year ago I was there and I was walking on all the streets, and now I see it on TV and now people see all the beauty that our people just built.
She says since officials in Russia found out in 2007 that they'd host this year's games, work has been underway to change a sleepy small town on the Black Sea into a Winter Olympics mecca. She says work immediately began to turn a diverse area with beaches near the Black Sea, but an abundance of snow in the mountains, into a place that millions of people would see.
It was a resort, but it was a place where people used to go in the summer or early autumn, perfect place to get in the sea. But now it is changed, and now I think it's all Four Seasons Resort. So now people can go there and ski and in a winter and swim in the summer.
Pomotenskaya says her reaction to what she sees on TV and what she hears from her family are equal to the pride she felt when the Olympic Committee originally announced the games would be in Sochi. She's excited about what the transformation could mean for her hometown.
I remember the first time I've heard that Olympics 2014 are going to be in Sochi, and I was, wow, this is really cool. It's going to take a lot of money, a lot of time and energy and effort, but in the end, it should be great, and that's what we got. And now, I think it's really cool, and it's going to just get better and better, and it will help Russia and Sochi.
She says it's just as exciting to think what the games and all the development will mean for the area once the Olympics are over.
It's just will make Sochi a better place, and obviously there will be more space for jobs and people can go there and start making their future, and especially students and everybody. It's a really good opportunity for Russian citizens.
She hopes to be able to go home this coming summer and looks forward to that first sight of what her home will look like.
I will be so excited because I can imagine that what kind of view I'll get when I'll be on a plane, because from the plane you can see all the sea and the buildings, and it would be awesome.
Pomotenskaya says she could not be prouder of her hometown. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
Whether they opt for a traditional ceremony, something a little more offbeat, or even a short courthouse certificate signing, pretty much every bride and groom-to-be has an ideal wedding. But one couple in eastern Kentucky never imagined their wedding would take place in a grocery store. Brendan McCarthy from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting brings us this audio postcard of the Stacys, who, with winter weather closing roads and courts, couldn't find a judge to sign their soon-to-expire marriage certificate until a lucky encounter at the Hazard Food City.
My name is Clinton Stacy.
My name is now Christina Stacy.
We worked together about 10 years ago at a grocery store, ironically, Winn-Dixie, that was here in town.
I honestly don't think we spoke to each other but maybe two words the whole time that he worked there.
And we started dating in March. We actually got engaged in November. And the 26th of December, we went and bought our marriage license. $40. $35.50 if you be technical, but we'll round it to $40.
So $35.50 is at stake here.
Right. You know, it doesn't seem like a lot of money, but, you know, in these times, you know, $35 comes, you know, it helps out. Any bit, penny pinching helps, you know. We had went religiously every week to try to catch one of the judges in their chambers to have them sign it.
But it just seemed like nothing was working out. The weather was bad. We can never catch a judge in office.
The marriage license is only good for 30 days. And we thought, you know, we're just going to have to chalk it up as a loss. You know, maybe it's just not meant to be this time. So we just, you know, well, we'll just go out later and get another marriage license and do it over. So we were just coming out to grocery shop. I had a pair of jeans and a sweatshirt on, and she had a pair of jeans and I think a long sleeve t-shirt.
As you can see, he's a big guy. He eats a lot of food. So we come here quite a bit.
And we're both the type that we like to be together with everything that we do. When I was parking, I saw a lady that I thought from behind, I said, that kind of looked like Judge Stevens.
I'm the Perry County District Judge. This is a small town. Everybody knows everybody. And if you don't know someone, you know someone who knows that person. Court was canceled because of the weather. I came to the store. I just needed a few things. I was on my way up to my boyfriend's mother's house.
We come around through the meat section, and I seen her at Judge Stevens in the produce aisle. And she cut down the organic food, so I kind of flanked her from the rear there and come in the front.
He said, I'm Clinton Stacy. This is my fiance, Christina Hall. And he said, we've had our marriage license for a while now, and court's been closed. As it turns out, it actually expired Friday, the day we did it.
She said, do you want me to sign them here? You know, kind of surprised, you know.
I've never been asked to do a wedding in Food City before, no.
I went out. I got the marriage license, and by the time I came in here, Judge Stevens was going to the Food City office to have the vows faxed to her from her secretary. Christina was going to the deli to grab a witness.
Judge Stevens said, you know, this is the Valentine's aisle. There's some arches here already. She said, what do you all think about this aisle? It is the Valentine's candy aisle, and there's the red and white arches up above like you would have in a wedding ceremony. The arches, candles, cards, love and hearts everywhere.
Snack cakes,
candy.
Food City has everything but the dress, right? They've got the cake, they've got the flowers, the decorations. They fixed up, it looked like a dozen roses. It was beautiful.
Anna is the manager of the deli, and she was behind me here during the ceremony. And I looked back, and actually her entire deli crew was behind us. There was actually three on each side.
Literally walked down the aisle. Yes, we did. Aisle four at Food City.
I give her, you know, a big open mouth kiss right here in aisle four. There is an eruption of applause and hoots and hollers going on behind us, and it was a nice little nice moment. After it was all said and done, the employees went back to work. Everybody went back grocery shopping. I think we passed Leanne, Judge Stevens there in the aisles a couple of times and checked out and went home.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The never-ending winter brought more snow across the region this past week, closing schools, government, and businesses, making roads treacherous, and forcing folks to once again clear sidewalks and dig cars out. But as West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly reports, there was a silver lining to the situation.
Winter storm dumped snow at a steady pace on Wednesday night and into Thursday. The conditions were challenging for road crews to keep just main roads clear. Several public transit systems were closed or delayed. Courts and government offices in many counties didn't open. And in Mercer County, several restaurants and businesses were closed for the day or shut down early because of wintry conditions. Governor Tomlin urged residents to stay home unless absolutely necessary. Like so many West Virginians, Byron Smith spent time in Martinsburg digging out his vehicle.
I have to get my car unstuck so I can go to work tomorrow. I have people waiting on paychecks, and I also have to pay a bill that's due tomorrow, so I feel the pressure to get the job done.
Cynthia Bainham, a retired school teacher, was out with her husband and a snowblower clearing the walk.
It's kind of nasty right now, but I enjoy it. I'm warm outside. I have extra long underwear on. And we have a snowblower, and it's working sufficiently to get all the snow off our great big sidewalk.
There's a pretty good chance that residents across the state are still shoveling out from the winter storm that barreled up the East Coast. The snow might have added work to the daily grind and treacherous road conditions to the daily commute, but it also created perfect conditions for sleigh riding. Students at Concord University enjoyed a day off, as did Mercer County Public Schools, so residents quickly flocked to campus to enjoy a Concord tradition.
My name is Cody Hunniker. I'm a sophomore from Winfield, West Virginia. A lot of college students, a lot of younger kids also. People come, I guess, all around. I mean, you gotta realize most of these people aren't college students. Coming down, sledding down, using trash bags and various other objects. It's just a good time. Concord is just a beautiful place, beautiful campus. There's not much to do around the city, but it's nice here. Being out in the middle of nowhere is beautiful.
My name is Brandon Perdue. I'm a sophomore here at Concord. I'm from Ashford, West Virginia. It's nice so you don't have to like travel all the way to Winter Place, and because no one can get out right now. Like the cars are covered. My car, there's no way I could get out in this, so it's just nice being able to just walk out of our dorm and just have fun. Someone brought out a mattress that they forced them to take it back in.
My name is Sarah Tolley. I'm a freshman here at Concord from Covington, Virginia, and we're here sleigh riding.
And so when they told you, hey, we're going to go sleigh riding on campus, what'd you think?
I was like, oh my gosh, we have to do it. So we got bundled up and now we're here. Morgan totally freaking busted her butt trying to climb up a snow mound.
My name is Morgan Trippett and I'm originally from Parkersburg, West Virginia. And we're out here having a good day for a snow day. I think it's a big thing because, I mean, you get everybody that comes around. I mean, not just us students here, but you get other people from the community. And we're kind of small, so we all kind of get together and we just have a good time. And it's just a lot of fun.
And I couldn't resist giving a sleigh ride a try after a slight nudge.
Oh, gosh. Well, I made it. Lots of spinning, but I made it. That was fun. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jessica Lilly in Athens.
While Jessica Lilly found some time to sled ride down a hill during the most recent winter storm, the Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shvetta Jordan also went looking for some outdoor fun, and she found it at a snow tube park.
Yeah. I'm a reporter, that's why I'm so goofy.
Getting on and off the conveyor belt that takes you up the hill can be the most worrisome part of this adventure. I slipped the first time.
It's our first time here, actually. We came one time before, and it was so crowded we couldn't get a pass.
You're about to get involved in a snowball fight here. Just stay here too.
That always seems to be the case. All right, buddy, come on, let's go.
Could you guys explain what you're doing here?
Tubing at Boyce Park.
Just sit like this and then put your feet out and just go this way and then
slide
down.
Right?
Yep.
Hang on tight.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say you've been here before?
I used to ski here when I was about her age, I guess, yeah.
Okay.
But I haven't been here in years and now I'm back to tube. It's pretty fun.
Do you know how high this is?
I really probably couldn't tell you about that. I did ask the guy how fast it was. I thought maybe around 30 miles an hour. And he said somebody did it with an iPhone, and he said they were going 27.
Now, was she not scared at all? Because I just went down, and actually, maybe it was because, you know, I was alone, but, like, I was surprised at how much I was going backward.
Yeah, and, me too. First, I flipped backwards.
And I was just like, yeah, I don't like speeding places and not knowing
not
where I'm going, but I'm like, okay, it can't be that dangerous, right?
Yeah.
So
she's not scared at all.
Yeah.
She's a little daredevil.
It seemed steep, kind of, so the first time we were scared, but after that it was pretty fun.
Okay, I'm ready to be pushed.
You want me to push you?
Oh, okay. Thanks, yeah. What? For the Allegheny Front, I'm Jennifer Shvetta Jordan.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.